you take then a moment to introduce today's Asthma Grand Rounds presenter, Dr. K. Frank Austin, head of the allergy research section here at the Rheumatology, Immunology, and Allergy Division at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. He is the AstraZeneca Professor of Respiratory and Inflammatory Diseases at Harvard Medical School. And I think, without much debate, the most influential allergist in the field of asthma over the last many decades. And we're very delighted to have as our speaker Dr. K. Frank Austin, who's going to be talking about one of multiple topics for his titles for his talk, which has something to do with the pathoimmunobiology of asthma being more innate than adaptive.
That's Dr. right. Austin. Thank you very much, Chris. The talk has indeed had three different titles. When Chris asked me to do this a year and a half ago, I had no idea what I would speak about, so I said mast cells. Then as it began to, the time approached, I thought, well, I really would talk about the system of leukotrienes. And then as I really began to think and prepare the talk, and I changed it really to the fact that I think there's compelling evidence that one of the reasons we've had so much problem in really understanding asthma is that it is very distinct from the autoimmune diseases, and it has a dominant innate component with some adaptive immunity attached. And so that's really the thesis that I want to develop. So what are some of the arguments before we actually get to the data? I think it's very important, and one of the really important insights are the failure of the drugs that are so effective in autoimmune diseases to do anything in bronchial asthma. That is, we still use bronchodilators and steroids which deal with end organ effects, but really have no specific, target-related specificity. Therapeutic agents with efficacy in autoimmune diseases, such as anti-TNF and others, have all failed in asthma. And the therapeutic agents that we've brought forward from the mouse models have all failed in asthma, including both anti-IL-4 and anti-IL-13. So someplace in there it says to us that maybe our fundamental thinking about bronchial asthma has to change from viewing it simply as another example of an immunologic disease. Now, there's evidence out there that should have made that obvious, at least in retrospect. We know that there are some cell or target-related disease agents that actually have efficacy in asthma. We know, for example, that monoclonal antibodies directed to the high-affinity IgE receptor do have efficacy in asthma. We know that blockade of the cystinyl leukotriene pathway, either its biosynthesis or its receptor-mediated action through CisLT1 or through inhibition of 5-lipoxygenase and now FLAP, are effective therapies in asthma directed against cells or pathways directly involved in the disease. We really didn't pay, in my view, didn't put adequate value on this information. But when you contrast it with the failures of the drugs for autoimmune disease, it highlights what works, even if it isn't spectacular. And I could have added chromalin sodium to that group. But the evidence is really more compelling than that. I've commented just here that we, as I say, that mast cells are implicated, cystinyl leukotriene pathway, which is one of the things mast cells, eosinophils, and basophils make, are implicated because of interventions. But there are two other things that I don't think we've really focused on adequately. The most striking is the allergens. Namely, the asthma problem, which is largely based in your homes, and in your everyday life, in your indoor life, these allergens carry their own innate signals. They activate not only TLRs, but they activate CLRs. So the allergens differ from ovalbumin and pure proteins by supplying their own adjuvants, and indeed, in all likelihood, more than one, meaning that these allergens can directly activate effector cells as well as prime the microenvironment for an antigen-induced immune response that is part of the total package. But in autoimmune diseases, we don't have that circumstance. And then you add to that something you all know, that viral infections of certain kinds profoundly cause disease flares. Indeed, there are patients that only flare in relationship to their viral infections. So here are pure, in a sense, innate types of signals. So, as I said, I began, and others like me have begun to think that we need to wonder why we don't have new therapies for this disease, and to want to convert that to a serious thinking about what the disease mechanisms really are. So the things I want to talk about today are the role of the system of leukotrienes and their receptors in mouse models of lung inflammation, and what are the things that we should now be thinking about. Some of the old and new evidence, which I know Josh Boyce talked with you a year ago, about the role of the third cystinoleukotriene, LTE4, which is the only one that is really persistent in a lesion. And then a third, in addition to emphasizing LTE4 a little, I want to emphasize negative regulation. Now, for those of you who study inflammation at all and think about this as a germline system that allowed us to survive in order to evolve the specificity of adaptive immunity, the germline system that is protective has to be able to be turned off. And I firmly believe that the negative regulation that exists in our germline is as important as the agonist or positive signals that it can send. I first learned this studying the complement system, which in the amplification pathway has more negative regulator steps than positive regulator steps. And it's really, as you go on to begin to study the system of leukotrienes and certain other systems, germline pro-inflammatory systems, you will always find as many or more negative regulator steps as positive. And without this negative regulation, this innate response, this germline response, would be lethal. It has to be limited. But we don't pay enough attention to how it's limited and the impact of that on the natural history of the disease, as well as perhaps in susceptibility. So I will, toward the end, get into negative regulation in a very large way. You'll find it a little hard to understand because much of the information is new. Now, this is the pathway that I'm going to use really for this discussion, and I need to be certain that we're all on the same page. This is a diagram from my colleague Yoshihide Kaneoka. Here is the nuclear membrane. Here is the plasma membrane. Presumably, this is a cell which, subjected to appropriate signal transduction, translocates phospholipase A2 type 4 from the cytosol to the outer nuclear membrane. At the same time, it translocates 5-lipoxygenase from the cytosol to the outer nuclear membrane. The phospholipase A2 releases arachidonic acid from the outer nuclear membrane. And in the presence of the 5-lipoxygenase activating protein, the 5-lipoxygenase converts this released arachidonic acid to leukotriene A4, which is an epoxide. FLAP, or 5-lipoxygenase activating protein, is an integral protein of the outer nuclear membrane, meaning it goes through. The 5-lipoxygenase then converts, as I said, the arachidonic acid first to a 5-hydroperoxyicosatetraenoic acid, and then to the epoxide leukotriene A4. At that point, another integral protein of the outer nuclear membrane becomes involved, LTC4 synthase. And LTC4 synthase conjugates glutathione to leukotriene A4 to form the 5-hydroxy, 6-glutathionyl icosatetraenoic acid, which is LTC4. All this is intracellular, and LTC4 is the only biosynthetically constructed cystinyl leukotriene. It leaves the cell of biosynthesis by a carrier-mediated export system, which is the multi-drug resistant pathway. Once it leaves the cell of biosynthesis, a gamma-glutamyl transpeptidase, or gamma-leukotrienase, removes the glutamic acid, leaving only the dipeptide adduct, and that's called LTD4, and then any dipeptidase, membrane-bound or free, removes the glycine, leaving LTE4. So that the three cystinyl leukotrienes have the same stereochemical structure to the lipid portion, but are progressively cleavage products of the tripeptide glutathione. And what Josh's group and my group have now recognized clearly is that each of these ligands has its own receptor and its own half-life and its own biology. Now, obviously, the more complex the system, the more reason for me to believe that it's there for a reason and that it has endured. So I'll just digress for just a second. Within the last few years, we completed the crystal structure of LTC4 synthase, but the cloning of LTC4 synthase, the human enzyme, was accomplished really in the laboratory by Bing Lam. We did it by expression cloning because it was a protein of the outer nuclear membrane, and to get enough protein to do it by sequence and to grow enough cells to do it that way proved really to be impossible. And so Bing devised a very ingenious expression approach to achieve the cloning. Now, what we found was quite surprising. The enzyme in the membrane is a trimer I've made up of three monomers. I've color-coded for you the monomers, and each monomer is made up of 5 alpha helices, 4 of which are inserted into the membrane. The important thing is, remember I said that glutathione is conjugated to LTA4 to make LTC4. The glutathiones exist between each of these three monomers, and they are lined up in a very specific fashion, meaning that the cell is loaded or preloaded with its glutathione, and all it has to do is see LTA4, and it will make LTC4. And what that looks like is shown here. This is the LTA4 inserted into the same groove. There's a flap on top to keep the area kind of hydrophobic, because the LTA4 hydrolyzes very rapidly in an aqueous situation. The two residues that turned out to be critical were a surprise, arginine 104 and arginine 31. It had always been believed that the activation of a glutathione involved tyrosine, but it turns out that in this kind of setting, it involves an arginine, which activates the glutathione to the thiolate anion, and it involves the arginine 31, which deals with the epoxide. Again, note that this glutathione, or this groove, is between two adjacent monomers. So the enzyme is a triple header. And what it does, and I should finish this, this arginine 104 activates the glutathione, arginine 31 donates the hydrogen, and you end up with LTC4. Now, Having the molecular knowledge of the enzyme, we not only did the crystal structure, and this was done with Japanese colleagues and by Yoshihide Kaneoka, we went on to do a knockout. That meant that we, after cloning it in the human, we cloned it in the mouse, and then went on to do a knockout. And this is work done by Ida Shu and Nora Barrett, who you all know. But very simply, this is an immunization program protocol in which the mouse is sensitized to ovalbumin by an intraperitoneal injection, and then after an appropriate interval, it is challenged by intranasal ovalbumin. This is normal lung, and this is the sensitized and challenged lung from the plus-plus mouse. You can see this tremendous accumulation of cells around the bronchovascular bundles. You can see here that within the bronchi, the silver stain picks up the mucus and the goblet cell hyperplasia, and also the laying down of extracellular matrix proteins. And there are now mast cells between epithelial cells, the so-called intraepithelial mast cell. None of this is present in a normal mouse. If we now take our knockout mouse, you can see a marked attenuation of this antigen or allergic elicited inflammatory response. There are fewer cells in the bronchovascular bundles, there is very little goblet cell hyperplasia, and there are no intraepithelial mast cells. So the absence of the cystinyl leukotrienes clearly protected the mouse in part against the allergic inflammation in this mouse model. It's principally Th2 type inflammation with some Th17, but it is not asthma, no matter what people write. Now, as we began to move to the study of allergens itself, Nora Barrett did a very interesting and important preliminary experiment. The data I just showed you is a whole mouse and it's protected. Is it protected because the leukotrienes are required for the effector cells to do something? Or is it protected because the leukotrienes are involved earlier in the innate immune response? Dendritic cells, as Michael Gurish has been trying to teach me and has now succeeded, are part of the innate immune system, not the adaptive in most current dogma. And Nora did a simple experiment in which she loaded dendritic cells with house dust mite. And then she grew the dendritic cells from bone marrow of wild-type animals and animals lacking the enzyme for LTC4 synthase. She then loaded the dendritic cells with house dust mite, used that as a sensitization strategy for plus-plus recipients, and after an appropriate interval, challenged them intranasally with the DurF. And what you see is that the mice deficient in LTC4 synthase had a markedly lower specific IgE response and a significant reduction in the eosinophils in the BAL fluid. So what this experiment does, it says that the role of the cystinyl leukotrienes is not limited to their action on the microvasculature. There is an action on the dendritic cell, which profoundly will influence the whole presentation and the kind of inflammation that one sees. Now, at about the time that we had used our understanding of LTC4 synthase to get the crystal structure, to make the knockout mouse, to move forward the biology, the industry identified for the first time two receptors. Now, the drugs that they had developed, the Leucasts, were not based on the receptors. They simply used the known structure of the molecules to develop inhibitors of the smooth muscle contractile activity of the cystinyl leukotrienes. But by some data mining combined with some molecular biology, the Jilly Evans and the Merck group cloned two separate receptors. which they called cisLT1 and cisLT2. They're on different chromosomes. There's very modest amino acid identity. The important thing for me and many others like me was that they demonstrated that these receptors were on bone marrow-derived cells. They were not just on the microvasculature and on the airway smooth muscle. That meant that this whole system could play a more fundamental role in the inflammatory response. Interestingly, from their cloning, they found that the affinity of D for cisLT1 was a log better than that the affinity of LTD4 for cisLT1 was a log better than that for LTC4, and that LTE4 was a lousy ligand for either one of these, suggesting that E might be of no consequence. And I'll come back to that, but since we already had a mouse lacking the enzyme that makes the cystinyl leukotrienes, LTC4 synthase, Yoshihide Kaneoka and Akiko Makawi went ahead to clone the mouse receptors and then to delete them. So we now had the three strains, the strain missing the biosynthetic enzyme and the strain missing each of the recognized or classical receptors. We did a simple permeability experiment in which one injects zymosin into the peritoneal cavity. Zymosin is a microbial cell wall carbohydrate that activates the dectin receptor on the macrophages in the peritoneal cavity, and they make cystinyl leukotrienes. At the same time that you inject the zymosin into the peritoneal cavity, Evans blue dye is administered intravenously. The Evans blue dye links to the plasma proteins. When they leak into the peritoneal cavity, they obviously carry this label, and they can be quantitated by their absorbance at 610 nanometers. So again, the plus-plus controls are black. The knockout animals are in the open circles. And this simply shows that an animal that cannot make cystinyl leukotrienes is about 50% attenuated in vascular leak during the first hour. If the animal is lacking the cisLT1 receptor, it is also about 50% attenuated during the first hour, but it actually continues for a longer time period. If the animal is missing the second classical receptor, cisLT2, there is no inhibition. At this point, we reached the simple conclusion together, namely that the cystinyl leukotrienes were important permeability-enhancing factors, and they worked through cisLT1. However, both Josh Boyce and I were very convinced that LTE4 needed to be dealt with. It's the only thing you really find in an inflammatory lesion. I should have said in that last slide, when we looked in the peritoneal cavity to see what was causing that leak, the only thing we could find was E, a little C. D has never been found in a lesion practically, so it has a minuscule half-life. So we wanted to focus much more on E. And it turned out that almost 30 years ago, we were in a collaboration, and this goes back to my good friend Jeff Drazen and E.J. Corey in the chemistry department at Harvard. And we had been generating our SRSA in the peritoneal cavity of the rat by an immunologic mechanism. Bob Murphy, who had helped us identify that SRSA was enriched for sulfur, had worked with Bengt Samuelsson in Sweden to generate SRSA with calcium ionophore from a mastocytoma cell line. And they had identified a single molecule, which E.J. Corey, in collaboration with all of us, showed was essentially LTC4. And so EJ made synthetic standards, but he made synthetic standards not just for LTC4, but for the cleavage products of the peptide. So if you start down here, when we subjected the SRSA that we made immunologically in the rat peritoneal cavity, we had three areas of biologic activity, three areas in which you could constrict the guinea pig ileum in an antihistamine-resistant fashion. When we looked at the OD280, which is favored for triains, we again could see the three peaks. And when we standardized this reverse phase HPLC system with the chemical molecules made by E.J. Corey, we could easily see that in our rat we had identified not just LTC4, but D4 in which the glutamic acid was removed, and E4 in which the glycine was removed. And they were all spasmogenic, and there were in fact three different ligands. Now, at the same time, we took these synthetic molecules that EJ had made. I should say that the reason EJ made these molecules is that when he looked at a molecule derived from arachidonic acid conjugated to a glutathione or a glutathione cleavage product, he said that there would be 128 possible stereoisomers. And he didn't know what the peptide length would be. So he basically said, doing this analytically will take forever. I'll make the candidate molecules I think make sense, and you guys run them against your purified native material, and that way we'll decide. When your purified molecule matches my synthetic molecule, we'll know the structure. So that's how that was truly done. In any event, we injected these three molecules into the skin of a guinea pig that we had also administered Evans blue dye. You get a nice blue spot when you change permeability. And C, D, and E were equal permeability factors. So E was clearly a biologically active molecule. We went further. Since EJ Corey had made these molecules in his laboratory across the river, we didn't have to go across any state lines, and we simply administered the three molecules to three of us, as compared to the dihydroxyleukotriene LTB4 and the prostanoid PGD2, and looked at the wheel and flare response. The three cystinol leukotrienes you can easily see are in yellow, green, and light blue. You can see that we got a marked wheel, and the wheel lasted much longer than the wheel from PGD2, and there was almost no wheel. Only one of the three developed any wheel at all from LTB4. The flare, interestingly enough, was still there when we went home 8 hours later. And these were tiny doses. So needless to say, I was ecstatic because it meant that this novel group of molecules was biologically active in a human. Jeff Drazen went on to study them with other colleagues in the laboratory by inhalation, and they were 1,000 times as potent as histamine in constricting the human airway. Now, that was C and D. E was only 10 times as potent as histamine. However, as far as I was concerned, E was as potent as C and D when it came to permeability, whether it was a guinea pig or whether it was a human. So we wanted to see how long D would last in a model system. And again, this is an old experiment. Very simply, it's a guinea pig ileum in an organ bath attached to a writing needle, and the red line is the contraction of the guinea pig ileum to a dose of LTD4. The blue line is the metabolism of the D4 to E4, with nothing in there but a guinea pig ileum, which is smooth muscle and mucosa. And you can see that as the D is metabolized to E in a linear fashion, the contraction falls 80% and then reaches a plateau. But it only takes 15 minutes or less. We repeated that experiment in the absence of the mucosa. Now remember, you people, when we think about asthma, we do have not just smooth muscle, we have with everything that surrounds smooth muscle. And here is the same contraction by D in the absence of mucosa. It goes up just as briskly. It stays up. There is no metabolism of D to E, and the contraction continues. And I show this only as an evidence how hard it is for D to do anything. We know D is active, but it has a very high affinity, but it has a very short half-life. And we must think of the other two ligands, which have different receptors and different functions. And in fact, Jeff Drazen and Tack Lee and AJ and I, based upon the different pharmacology of CDNE, wrote a paper saying there would be three receptors in 1980 or 82. Now, nobody paid any attention to us. E was clearly overlooked. LTE was less active on the normal human airway than C and D. I said that C and D were 1,000 times as potent as histamine. E was only 10 times as potent. So some people looked at E as a degradation product and concentrated on C and D. Once the Merck group had cloned the two, quote, classical receptors and found that E wasn't a good ligand, that again was very important data to say that E was of not a major player in human asthma. However, E was as active as C and D in a vascular assay, as I mentioned, in guinea pig or human. And John Arm and Tack Lee showed very nicely that if you now study these molecules in asthmatics, that C and D are only 10 times as active as histamine in an asthmatic, whereas they are 1,000 times as active in a normal. And E, on the other hand, retains its activity as you move from normals to asthmatics. So John Arm actually has said that asthmatics are hyperactive to E. But again, when you consider all this, you might, as we do, wonder why E was neglected, and you can appreciate why Josh and I continued to be excited about pursuing E. We've done it by different approaches, and with Yoshihide Kaneoka and Akiko Makawi, as I told you a few moments ago, we had knocked out the cis-LT1 and the cis-LT2 receptor, and so we made a double receptor knockout. So now we have a mouse in the open symbols that doesn't have either classical receptor. In the closed circles, you have a wild-type mouse. And what Akiko did was simply inject the cystinoleukotrienes into the ear and look at the permeability change. That is, the leukotrienes went into the ear, the Evans blue dye went in intravenously. And then you extract the ear, and the protein in the ear is labeled, and that tells is a quantitative measurement, really, of the edema. Well, the most striking initial finding was that a mouse lacking both classical receptors got just as much edema from C and D as a wild-type mouse possessing both receptors. That was despite the fact that the literature stated categorically that analysis of the genome had indicated there would not be another receptor. When we injected E, we were astonished to find not only was it active? It gave us a bigger signal than C or D. So, what all good pharmacologists do is they do a dose response. And here is a dose response study in the wild type mice and in the double receptor knockout mouse with C, D, and E. If you look across for C or you look across for E, the dose response is pretty much the same. There is a receptor in the null animals for C and D. If you look for E, it is markedly more responsive. The lowest dose, 0.008 nanomoles, is as active in the double receptor knockout as the 0.5 dose is in the plus-plus, meaning that in the absence of the classic receptors, there is a 60-fold, 4-fold increase in potency of E. And you note this, there is a tail that we've never seen before. So there are really two things going on. There is a peak and there is a tail, which means that the complexity of this E response in the double knockout is yet to be fully resolved. As part of that, I just wanted to show you that this isn't just a matter of leaking blue dye. This is actually the tissue. And here is the wild-type mouse. Here is the double receptor knockout mouse. This is the challenged ear with E. You can see how much more swelling there is at 30 minutes. It's all extracellular. There's no cellular infiltrate. And even at 6 hours or 4 hours, there is still swelling because of the tail in the double receptor knockout mouse. We then added some complexity by doing some pharmacologic studies. The first ones we did was to block the reaction with B pertussis and with a Rho kinase inhibitor to satisfy us that this action of E in the double receptor knockout mouse most likely involved a G-coupled protein. And then we wanted to see whether this new receptor, uncovered by removal of the other two, would be inhibited by leucast or a leucast-like drug because they were selective and powerful inhibitors of CisLT1. And we were really surprised. You have to look at this very carefully, and I will go slowly. The closed symbols at the bottom here are the wild-type mouse. And if you in the wild-type mouse, if it's dotted, there is no drug. If it's a solid line, there is a CisLT1 antagonist. So that, as expected, this is the response to E, C, and D, and whatever response there was as indicated by the solid symbol in a wild-type mouse and the dotted line, it is inhibited by the CisLT1 antagonist. But when we turn to the double knockout, we have the opposite effect. In the double knockout, the symbols are the open circles, and the presence of the drug MK-571, which is a surrogate leucast, is indicated by the solid line. So that if we look over here with LTE4, here is the response in the double knockout. And if we now add a leucast-like drug, which is capable of inhibiting the response in a wild-type mouse, it is significantly increased. And the same is true whether we're looking at LTC4 or LTD4. Look at the open circles and look at the dotted line as compared to the solid line. The solid line is with the CisLT1 inhibitor in the mouse. So this new receptor, uncovered by the absence of the other two, is not only not inhibited by the leucast, it is enhanced. And it is selectively and powerfully acted upon by LTE4, which is the cystinoleukotriene that hangs around and which you all know comes out in the urine of the asthmatic patients during exacerbations can even be found in the blood. So, what does this say? We've called this novel receptor cisLTE because we haven't cloned it yet. And we want to give it a trivial name just until we know exactly what it is. At the moment, it's really a function that we can easily see in a mouse lacking the other two receptors. The response to C and D is intact, so it's not just an E receptor. The response to E and these others is enhanced 64-fold. It's blocked by B pertussis as well as by Rho kinase inhibitors. E is the only ligand that gives the prolonged tail. C and D do not. So it's unlikely to be the conversion of C and D to E because there is no tail. The response to all three is enhanced by MK571, which of course is a surrogate for montelukast. And as I said, this is clearly resistant, if not enhanced. Well, we then thought we better go from a pharmacologic study to a simple immunologic reaction to see if what we had learned about this third receptor would also be apparent in an immunologic injury type setting. So here is a simple PCA reaction in which one ear is sensitized with monoclonal antibody to IgE, the other gets saline, the mast cells get sensitized in the one ear, haptene-specific antigen is administered the next day, the mast cells are activated, they leak, and you can measure the leak either by thickness or by the Evans blue dye if that has been injected. Now, we did this with a minimal dose of the monoclonal IgE antibody in order to be able to see upregulation. So we used 10 nanograms instead of the usual 25, and there was a small response in the wild-type mouse. Focus first only on the open symbols. There was really no change in the mouse lacking cisLT1. There was a marked increase in the mouse lacking cisLT2, and there was a perfectly good response in the mouse lacking both receptors. So this isn't just a pharmacologic experiment. You can see it in a classical immunologic reaction that is mast cell dependent, mediated by the IgE class antibody. But there's more to that than this. What is this response in the cisLT1 knockout? Is it the third receptor? Why is this response going up in the cisLT2 knockout? The answer to this really lies again in Josh Boyce's earlier studies, in which he has nicely shown with his colleagues that the cisLT2 receptor is a negative regulator of the cisLT1 receptor in a proliferation assay and in other in vitro signaling assays. So in fact, cisLT2, one of the two classical receptors in our hands, is not an agonist receptor. It is a negative regulator. And you could beautifully see this in vivo as well as in vitro. So this has profoundly changed our thinking about this whole pathway. And then, of course, we added montelukast. And in this simple PCA reaction, it increased the intensity of the leak. So our findings with montelukast for this third receptor in the absence of the classical receptors held up for an immunologic reaction. There clearly is a third receptor. It responds to all the cystinolocotrienes. It prefers E, and it's upregulated by the conventional receptor blocker. Now, that is in the skin. So before I go to the airway very briefly, let me just say again where we are. Because the cystinolocotriene pathway, as I progress through this today, is getting more and more complicated and should give you some insight as to why the clinical interventions have been somewhat less than we would have liked based on a simple interpretation that the only player is cis-LT1 and that all patients are similar. So we now know that deletion of the cis-LT2 receptor can increase the response to the cis-LT1 receptor in a PCA reaction, and it can also increase the response to the cis-LTE receptor in a PCA reaction, and that the addition of a Lucas drug can actually make it worse. Now, this is an early experiment from Akiko Makawi in a Durev-sensitized and challenged mouse. I want you to ignore these panels. I'm only going to talk about these three because I really want to, again, focus on negative regulation and complexity. So this is the BAL fluid, and we're looking at neutrophils, lymphocytes, and eosinophils. This is an early experiment, so you can see that some controls were wild-type, some were heterozygotes. But in contrast to the PCA, the mouse lacking the cis-LT1 receptor was completely blocked in the recruitment of these three cell types into the airway, meaning that that response is profoundly dependent on cis-LT1. When we then looked at the mouse lacking cis-LT2, you go from nothing to this phenomenal increase, showing that when cis-LT1 is present and only the cis-LT2 receptor is deleted, that it is such a powerful negative regulator that you get a tremendous increase in accumulation of these cells in the airway. And finally, in the double knockout, it's not as dramatic as it is in the PCA, but there is a perfectly good response in the absence of any of the two classical receptors. And interestingly, for the eosinophil, it's virtually as good as in the absence of cis-LT2. Again, I just wanted to show this early data to indicate the complexity and the fact that all the focus on the human so far that has been looked at genomics that I'm aware of, has not remotely distinguished the complexity of the reaction and the competing functions of cis-LT1 and cis-LT2. Now, before you think you understand it, I need to give you one more, which behaves in a normal fashion. This is again from the work of Akiko Makawi and Yoshihide Kaneoka, who have recognized that there is a non-ligand binding receptor, GPR17, that is a constitutive regulator of cis-LT1. In a beautiful set of studies, they demonstrated this first by transfections, then by knockdowns, and now by a knockout, and this is a PCA. Again, we always set it up with a 10 nanogram dose so that the plus-plus animal gives a low response so that you can see enhancement. So here is a plus-plus animal in a PCA reaction. Here is an animal mouse lacking GPR17. A phenomenal increase. But this one is completely inhibited by MK571. So that when the negative regulator is entirely directed to cis-LT1, the susceptibility of cis-LT1 to the Lucas family is maintained. When you have eliminated cis-LT1 and you're dealing with the new receptors, then the Lucas behave in a very different fashion. So this is a scheme that Akiko Makawi and Yoshihide Kaneoka and Josh Boyce and I have been seeking to diagram just to get you thinking about the complexity of the situation. So first I want to remind you that there are three cis-leukotrienes. They are not the same. They're structurally different. Their half-lives are different. Their preferred receptors are different. C actually has a very good binding capability for cis-LT2, which is a negative regulator for cis-LT1. GPR17 is a constitutive negative regulator of SSLT1 that is not ligand dependent. Both SSLT1 and SSLT2 appear to be negative regulators of the SSLTER, that when we remove both of them, we see a dramatic increase in its presence. And Josh's work has shown very nicely that there is an interaction between a P2Y12 signal and an LTE4 signal. So there appear to be at least two pathways for LTE4 to mediate changes in vascular permeability and in inflammation. And it's worth keeping in mind that that is the molecule you find in the lesion. And since it is so abundant, I'm not surprised if it turns out to have a lesser affinity than C and D do for their receptors, because they are going to be very transient. Now, obviously, I believe E is a great therapeutic target. That shouldn't surprise anybody at this point. It's stable to the mucosal dipeptidases, more stable than the other leukotrienes. Interestingly enough, with TAC-LE, we showed many years ago that it's resistant to the respiratory burst, because when you have an inflammatory focus, especially with neutrophils and even more with eosinophils, their peroxidase will cleave the sulfur bond and will convert any cystinyl leukotriene to the sulfide and then to the completely inactive all-trans LTB4. E is more stable locally as well as systemically. As I said, E, you can find it in the BAL in the urine. This new receptor appears to be insensitive to the Lucas blockade. The E and its receptor signals are as good as those of C and D when it comes to the skin, and E is certainly almost as good as C and D on the airways of asthmatic individuals. Indeed, as I said, John Arm and others have referred to it as a kind of hyperreactivity. One can either engage, my preference would be an active site inhibitor so that you leave everything else intact, or if we ever characterize this receptor, one could deal with it more selectively. What are the issues? And I think there may be many more than I've thought of. How might negative regulation of SSLT1 by GPR17 or by SSLT2 influence the asthma phenotype? In one case, Lucas might work, in the other case, they might not work. And how is this information, if it applies to the human, as I say, influence our analysis of the asthma phenotype and our understanding of therapy and its effectiveness? Could the SSLTER receptor be uncovered in severe or persistent inflammation? Receptors tend to downregulate when they see their ligand. And so one possibility is not that individuals differ in the SSLT1 and SSLT2 so much, but that it is influenced by chronic inflammation, and then this receptor that I've talked about today could be uncovered. And very importantly, for which we've done nothing, and neither has anybody else really, what are the innate signals that regulate the baseline levels of SSLT1, SSLT2, GPR17, and SSLTE? So what happened was the industry developed intervention before we understood the pathway at all, before receptors had been cloned, before LTC4 synthase had been cloned, before the complexity was appreciated. It's a good thing, because that intervention has led to attention to the field, but I think it's now time to begin to re-examine the whole structure and to develop a whole new set of therapeutic approaches. Thank you.